Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking on urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. My guests today are Paul Swinney and Naomi Clayton, colleagues of mine at the Centre for Cities. And today we're going to be talking about Brexit and its potential or likely impact on cities across the UK. So the context is, over the last week or so, a flurry of assessments of various Brexit deals have been released looking at the different impacts on the economy. Only the government study looked at the geography of the different deals and how they might affect different areas, which I think is interesting in itself and somewhat revealing about how we think about the economy. But Naomi, just start by giving us an overview of, you know, if you looked at all of those studies and the various assessments, what are the kind of big stories or big headlines that they're all telling us?
We had four impact studies published last week, and each of them were looking at slightly different scenarios, but all of them looked at the impacts of a Canada-style free trade agreement and the likely impacts of that relative to if the UK had stayed in the EU. The studies show that national income, GDP, is likely to be around 2 to 6% lower than if the UK had stayed in the EU. They're predicting that economic output will be around 4% lower, and that equates to around £2,000 per person per year by 2030.
We should say, for the purposes of those that are interested in this sort of stuff, all of the assessments are very clear that these are scenarios, or they're trying to paint pictures of. They're not accurate predictions of actually what will happen and the numbers, but actually just giving a sense as to the kind of impacts that you're likely to see and the magnitude of them depending upon different deals.
Absolutely. It's not an exact science. The exact costs of Brexit are highly uncertain, and the models and impacts are dependent on, from these models are dependent on the assumptions that are made within them.
Only the government's assessment really looked at some of the geography of how this might play out differently across the country, which, as I said, I think is kind of revealing in the way that some of this assessment work gets thought about, or at least how the country works, is quite interesting. Just give us a sense as to what the government's assessment, when they looked at the regional breakdown or the regional profiling, said about which places would be more or less affected.
Well, it really does vary according to the scenario that they're considering. And so there are a number of different scenarios in the government's impact model. And essentially, it's dependent on the extent to which the deal is focused on goods relative to services. For instance, if the UK stays within the customs union and tariffs for goods remain at zero, then actually some of the regions that are more heavily kind of specialised in manufacturing and the export of goods might be relatively less affected than places like London that are more specialised in financial and business services. That changes though if there's a no deal, and actually we see the costs of trade increasing across the board. We then need to obviously take consideration of the extent to which regions are dependent on trade with the EU. And in that case, places like the North East that have quite a close relationship in terms of exports with the EU might be relatively more effective.
And that's kind of reflecting the the industrial and occupational structure of different places and the degree to which some are more reliant on or have more employment and activity in certain industries rather than others, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And so, you know, our analysis on the trade effects of Brexit showed that in terms of the initial shocks of a change in the UK's trade relationships with the EU, that actually cities that are more specialised in the financial and business services are likely to be affected greater, at least initially.
Yeah, and so the government's study looks at some of the impacts at the regional scale, at the and looks at the the different regions across the country, including Northern Ireland, obviously, and Scotland and Wales. Whereas the work that we did a while back actually went further than that and tried to at least get a handle on the effect that Brexit and different scenarios, hard and soft at that stage, would have on actually the cities that we particularly look at. So just say something about, you know, what, again, at the headline level, what we observed when we, you know, when we did that work with our colleagues at the London School of Economics.
Yeah, so we worked with the Centre for Economic Performance at LSE to look at the potential impacts of both a soft Brexit, where the UK reaches a free trade agreement with the EU, and then where the UK fails to reach an agreement and the default is to trade under World Trade Organization rules. And we were essentially applying CEP's national model to the local level so that we could look at the potential impacts on cities. And because in part the model predicts that the costs of doing trade will be more significantly increased on the services side, it's actually places like London, other cities in the greater southeast, and cities like Edinburgh and Aberdeen that are likely to be hit hardest under both scenarios.
You know, the interesting point there was that that was counterintuitive in some respects at the time, because, you know, in the way we would think about those sorts of cities, we would classically, traditionally regard them as being more successful cities and they seem to be more exposed. Whereas, you know, there's quite a bit of analysis around the time and still around weaker places being those that are affected.
Absolutely. And that's why it's so important to emphasise that through that modelling, we were looking at the initial effects of Brexit in terms of the trade effects. So we didn't look at the effects in terms of migration, FDI, and then the knock-on impacts on productivity within that study.
Yeah.
And we weren't considering how places might respond to some of those shocks either. And so the concern is that where the model suggests that everywhere will be negatively affected under both scenarios, and that economic output will be lower as a result. The concern is that in cities where levels of unemployment and already high, and the economies are effectively still struggling with the impacts of the 2008 financial crisis, that actually even just a small shock might have much bigger ramifications, and those economies might find it much more difficult to adapt to the changes brought about by Brexit.
Yeah, so we'll come on to that sort of, as you say, the short and long term, but then, you know, how we think places may respond and the degree to which, you know, the existing economic performance geography that we see, how that kind of, that we think that might play out and how we might need to respond to that. But just to kind of finish off on this, so some of the work, some of the studies looked at, they also rolled in questions and issues in relation to migration. Although obviously we don't have the immigration white paper, which we were due to have, but now looks to be, you know, as always, very close to Christmas, that we may or may not get the government's white paper on how the immigration system may work in a post-Brexit context. But we also looked at migration and looked at, again, how that played out across different cities. Give us some of the headlines on that so we can kind of roll that into our considerations as well.
Well, our analysis shows that some of the trade effects of Brexit may well be compounded by changes in migration. And so we know that migration is an incredibly important part of city economies, and that most migrants will locate in the UK's largest urban areas, particularly London. So, you know, migrants are really important to city economies, not just because that's where they tend to locate, but they also tend to be more highly skilled compared to the resident population. They tend to be younger and they're more likely to be in work. And they work in a range of different industries. So the concern is that Brexit may well lead to skills shortages in some of those kind of lower skilled or lower wage sectors, as well as some of the high skilled, high wage sectors and industries.
Yeah, which then may have additional effects on the way that internal labour markets function in the UK, which may exacerbate actually some of the problems that we already see, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So that we've already seen that there's been a drop in migration to cities since the 2016 referendum, and of course, you know, there are significant consequences in terms of international migration, but we need to consider those against the dynamics of domestic migration. So a lot of international migrants locate in London. London will undoubtedly be affected by changes to the immigration system in the UK, but it also might fill some of those skills shortages by drawing more people in from across the UK.
Yeah, no, quite. I think that area has been underappreciated, I think, in some respects, about how, you know, some of that more skilled labour that currently chooses to stay in other cities may be drawn into London or into some of the more successful cities, which might actually exacerbate geographical variation over time as those places lose some of the labour that they've been able to retain or keep hold of, which I think, as I say, is underappreciated. Okay, so let's kind of broaden this out now to so we have the assessments from the government. We've done our own work, thinking about how, you know, the impact of Brexit and how it plays out and how it informs and influences the longer term sort of economic geography that we see across the country. Paul, bring you in. There was just paint a picture for us about, you know, the pattern of economic performance that we've seen in some respects, some of our work going back over 100 years. So just give us paint a picture of that, and then we can talk about whether we think Brexit exacerbates or might ameliorate some of those issues.
Looking at the historic context of this, I think, is really, really important because it helps answer what potentially is a very difficult question of what impact will Brexit have across the country. Now, if we go back, say, to 1911, like we did in our Century of Cities work, what we see back then is that cities were very much places of low-cost production. You know, they were the cheapest places where you could go and set up your business and churn out whatever it is you churn out, chips, coal, etc. Why is that? Well, that's because you've got the coal under your feet to pull out the ground, and you've got a fuel source, you're close to the sea because of rivers and ports, and you've got lots of workers you can access as well. Now, there's been quite big changes over the 20th century that have rendered those advantages that cities had to being sort of, you know, less advantageous. So you've got rail and road coming in, meaning it's easy to move goods around. You've got containerization, meaning that ports became less important, or different types of ports became important. And you've got electricity as well. You know, those businesses that were tied to cities because it had to be close to their fuel source, all of a sudden they could go in and locate anywhere because you had the national grid come into play. So what that's then meant is that cities have shifted from being places of low-cost production to being places of knowledge production. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not cheap to operate within cities today. You know, businesses that have got business models which are based around, you know, low cost aren't choosing to be located in cities. Instead, what we're seeing increasingly is that those high-skilled, high-knowledge businesses are the ones that want to be based within cities because of the advantage that cities offer. That's access to lots of skilled workers. It's also access to a network of other businesses that they can share information with too. Now, that then means that those cities that successfully made that change over the last 100 years are the ones that do well today. You know, London is the most obvious example of that. But you've got places like Reading, Milton Keynes, Leeds, Edinburgh that have done that too. But of course, you've got a number of other cities that haven't adjusted particularly well. Places like Blackburn and Burnley or Middlesbrough or Wakefield, you know, have probably struggled to a greater extent over that period. And we see now that their economies don't function very well. And we see, therefore, then the geography of opportunity, I think, that we see across the UK today, in that some places do very well and some places don't. And it's all down to how they've been able to adapt to those changing global winds over the last century.
Okay, that's very helpful. So, where do we think Brexit leaves us, or how that will play out, Naomi, in terms of the performance and the rationale that we've seen across our cities? You talked a little bit about early on, but just expand on that in terms of, you know, if we're thinking about the local effects of Brexit, does it make, you know, the divisions more stark, or might we see some of those divisions shrink as places like London, you know, may well be hit disproportionately hard, at least in the short run?
Yeah, I think it all comes back to local economies and cities' ability to respond to these impacts. And the concern is really that Brexit will, eventually kind of work to widen socioeconomic disparities across the country. I think it's useful to look back to the 2008 financial crisis and how local economies responded to that. You can see when you look back to 2008 that London's economy was relatively hard hit initially in terms of the impact on particularly the financial services sector. But since then, its economy has grown significantly. It's seen among the fastest growth in the UK, and its economy is now around 40% larger than it was in 2008. Meanwhile, other cities that were relatively less affected initially by the impacts of the financial crisis have seen much slower growth and have really struggled to recover from the effects of the financial crisis. So I think that's a useful lesson for thinking about how cities might respond to some of the effects of Brexit, and suggest that cities like London and other much more kind of economically buoyant cities with more diverse economies, more highly skilled workforces, might well be better placed to respond to the impacts of Brexit, while others might well struggle more.
Paul? I think the question is, why would Brexit make these places that have perhaps struggled over the last 20, 30, 40 years, why would it make them more attractive as places of investment for high-skilled businesses? And the answer to that is, it won't. You know, there are much bigger fundamental challenges that these cities face that have to be addressed. You know, either way if we'd stayed in the EU or if we'd left, you know, the July 2016 isn't a turning point in that factor. You know, it's these bigger fundamental challenges, particularly around skills, as Naomi says, that have to be addressed if we want to see places that are struggling perform better in the future. Now, it's quite interesting. I think the Brexit vote really is a culmination of something where the seeds were sown probably in the 70s and 80s, where you've seen this fall away of perhaps more traditional industry, and these cities have really struggled to adapt to be sort of more knowledge-based, to attract in these new higher skilled type businesses. And the question we have to ask ourselves is, particularly around domestic policy, is why are these businesses not locating within these localities currently? And what should we do about that to change it? And I don't think we've seen anything since the referendum result that really has tried to address that. And indeed, actually, the great irony is, despite the Brexit vote, I think, being an alarm bell to show that, you know, people are dissatisfied with the opportunities that they see sort of in and around their areas, we haven't had really any proper and meaningful discussion about what domestic policy looks like to try and address that challenge that has been flagged up by the referendum result.
Yeah, so I mean, so if it hasn't changed the response, the nature of the response, does it make the response more difficult? I suppose, Naomi, in a sense that, you know, we know that places over time have suffered from, you know, fairly long run problems on the skills side or on business investment side, some to varying degrees around questions about the physical infrastructure and connectivity of their place. I think some have struggled with kind of having good institutions in their places, you know, political and civic and business leaders that can make the decisions that support the long-term success of those sorts of areas. I suppose, you know, my concern, if you share it, is all of those things are evident and need to be addressed, and Brexit just makes it all the more difficult.
Well, you know, a lot of the problems that cities face predate Brexit. They're kind of long running. And I suppose Brexit makes addressing some of those challenges more difficult, in part because we're effectively having to do more with less, you know, because the economic impacts of Brexit are going to affect government revenues and affect government spending. So I think it's even more critical that local government and their partners are taking stock of what works to improve economic outcomes and really focusing on trying to design and deliver the most effective policies to support their local economies.
And you, just follow up on that. So you've been doing quite a lot of work going around the country, working with combined authorities, with cities, with towns, you know, the whole kind of gamut, looking at and thinking about how they consider and reflect on questions in relation to the local industrial strategies. Because one of the main policy mechanisms the government has proposed to deal with some of the Brexit-related challenges is the national industrial strategy on the one hand and the local industrial strategies as part of that. And you've been around the country kind of talking to different places about how they think about those sorts of things. Just give us a sense as to where places are, you know, what some of the issues that are emerging. Are they thinking differently than maybe they did in the past? Has there been a change in the way they at least try to understand the nature of their place?
Yeah, so, you know, the industrial strategy is the government's flagship domestic policy, aiming to support productivity growth across the country. And as part of that, all local enterprise partnerships and combined authorities are expected to agree local industrial strategies by early 2020. And these are really meant to focus on prioritising the long-term opportunities and challenges for boosting productivity as they relate to effectively the foundations or drivers of productivity. So skills, innovation, business environment, infrastructure and place within that. And I think, you know, places are kind of grappling with some of the challenges and tensions that have been thrown up by the local industrial strategies, and in particular this idea that they'll need to prioritise for the longer term, and the fact that these documents aren't meant to be bidding documents, but are meant to unlock funding further down the line, and in particular unlock the Shared Prosperity Fund. So there are challenges in terms of kind of building the evidence base, making sure that they're consulting widely with the private sector to try and really understand what the barriers to growth are in the local economy, and then prioritise within all of that. But also in terms of thinking about what's going to fund the local industrial strategies. There are big questions about that, given that we're awaiting the consultation of the Shared Prosperity Fund. And then, of course, we've got the spending review in
2019. Yeah, no, very. And Paul, Naomi's talked about the local industrial strategy stuff. You know, we've done quite a bit of work on the national industrial strategy and advocating for more of a kind of geographical perspective and understanding in order to get at some of these real sort of drivers. Just say something about, you know, that perspective and, you know, what we would ideally want to be seeing, and then we'll talk a little bit more around, you know, how these different levers play out.
Well, interestingly, I think when you look at productivity, which is the big challenge, you know, when we have had discussion about domestic policy, it has been around productivity, and the industrial strategy is right to look at that. We hear stats such as, you know, the German worker produces in 4 days what the UK worker produces in 5, which is a great soundbite. But of course, that hides all sorts of variation underneath that. And if you start to break that down regionally, what you see is that actually worker in the greater southeast of England produces more on a weekly basis than what a German worker does. And it's other parts of the economy where we see that actually there really is that productivity gap. So if we're thinking about productivity, you know, we've got to think about the geography of this. In the same way that, you know, if we're thinking about Brexit, we've got to think about the geography of this. And it comes back to this challenge, particularly if cities elsewhere in the country really punching below their weight, you know, having not made that transition from places of low cost to places of knowledge production. And the question is, why is that? Well, the benefits that high-skilled businesses are looking for, you know, these cities are not offering in the way that they need to be offering to really attract those types of businesses in. And that's where we need to focus. So again, the national industrial strategy needs to be thinking about, why do businesses locate where they do? And why do particularly high-skilled, what we would call exporting businesses, these footloose businesses, why do they choose to locate in the greater southeast to drive up, which then drives up the productivity of the greater southeast? And therefore, what do we need to do to try and emphasise the benefits that other places can offer to try and attract that type of investment in elsewhere too? Now, that's down to skills, that's down to local transport, that's down to the way that their city centres operate. You know, it's all about, how do you get a Sheffield or how do you get a Middlesbrough to be a place where you get this concentration of activity, high-skilled activity in one place, and that drives on the productivity of their areas and then has implications in terms of wages in the areas, the amount of money that's in people's pockets, and therefore how they feel about the economic opportunity and what their standards of living look like.
Mm. I mean, so just pick up on that and take that on a little bit further around. Let's just highlight some of the issues and questions around the skills sort of policy area. You know, what are we seeing? What's the sort of responses that we would ideally like to see in different places?
Well, you know, we know that skills is one of the most important factors in determining economic outcomes, both at the kind of individual level and at the city level, as well as the national level. And as Paul has said, one of the most important reasons why we see such kind of spatial variation in terms of economic outcomes is because of the skills of the workforce. So, you know, places across the country are thinking very hard about how they improve the skills of their populations as part of their local industrial strategies. One of the frustrations is that they don't necessarily have the levers and mechanisms that they need to try and affect change in that space. So there's an ongoing conversation about kind of devolution in that policy area, and you know, it will need to be part of the discussion and debate around the devolution framework. So of course there's that kind of conversation, and then there's what partners can do now to try and improve kind of skills locally, and the work that we've done kind of looking at some of the longer term changes in the economy and what that means for the skills system shows that actually we need to be starting from the early years. We see quite significant spatial divides between cities when we look at kind of rates of achievement in the early years, and those divides persist if not widen over time. So there's a need to be thinking about early years, school performance as part of the mix in terms of improving the kind of skills of residents. But then, of course, the vast majority of people who will be in the workforce in 2030 have already been through compulsory education. So we need to be thinking about adult education and lifelong learning as well, and how we increase participation and improve outcomes in terms of lifelong learning too, because you know that's been declining over the longer term, and we've seen a significant drop in employer investment in workforce development since the EU referendum, as they're already starting to deal with some of the costs of Brexit. So we need to think quite carefully about the kind of best ways to do that. And there's some good evidence on the impacts of kind of employment training and apprenticeships. But I think the the local industrial strategies do offer the opportunity to try and experiment more in this space, so that we get kind of better evidence about what works to improve skills.
Yeah, and one of the benefits that some allocate to Brexit is that, you know, as migration becomes tighter, in a sense, the numbers allowed into the country reduce, that will have some positive effect on businesses in the UK to invest more in their workforce, or to, you know, to potentially skill up those people that they can no longer get from other parts of the European Union, or indeed of the globe. Your thoughts on that? I mean, is whether that's a likely or potential outcome, or was that just, you know, wishful thinking?
I think, you know, that's certainly one of the things that's been kind of raised as an opportunity as part of Brexit. But, you know, many businesses aren't investing now. And as I've said, we've seen a significant drop in business investment in workforce development. So, you know, I think there's the chance that Brexit will actually work to reinforce some of the longer running trends in this space, which is why it is so important that you know, government and local government are focused on ways to try and encourage, promote and support employers to invest more in workforce development and training.
The geography of this is very interesting as well, though, because I think if you you know, if you look at certain places, particularly in the north of England, you see there's a very large share of people that have no formal qualifications at all. If you then look at the structure of their economies, you know, it's reflective of that. You know, a lot of the activity they have is pretty low skilled. Now, we don't tend to have seen a great deal of migration into those cities. Our research shows that, and Naomi, we talked about this earlier as well, about how a lot of international migration goes into London and other cities in the greater southeast. So we've got this situation here where, you know, you've got a city in the north of England not doing very well, where migration levels have been pretty low. So it's not as if, you know, sort of domestic labour is being replaced by migrants coming from elsewhere. We've got a lot of people with very few formal qualifications, but we've got businesses that are pretty low skill, quite routinised in terms of the activities that they do. That type of business is not going to invest loads and loads of money in retraining because it doesn't need skilled labour. You know, and it's either you've got a person there sort of doing this activity over and over again in a routinised manner, or there may well be a machine sort of doing that instead. So as things have stood in the past, there's been very little incentive, I think, for those businesses to invest in people in those places. Brexit, therefore, is not going to change that. You know, even if we do have tighter migration laws or rules, that's not really going to affect the amount of migration going into some of these struggling places because the opportunity isn't there anyway. And that's not going to change the incentives that those businesses face in terms of investing. So particularly in places that have struggled over the last 20 or 30 years, I don't think Brexit's going to have any impact on that incentive for business to invest in their workforce.
Yeah. So crudely then, if skills and education, which we regard as being fundamental, if I could say that, you know, in the sort of conversation about how we help places become more successful in the future, I think skills and education is often underappreciated as the, you know, the fundamental factor. And can, you know, people I'm sure out there would debate that, but that's my sense. An overappreciated or overemphasized, overprioritized intervention is in and around transport and infrastructure more generally. You know, in a sense, you hear a lot of conversations about, you know, the future of the Midlands or the northern cities is, you know, is fundamentally held back by transport constraints. And we know that there are, and there are pockets of those sorts of things, but it seems to me that that's over-prioritised. Paul, do you give you a reflection on that?
Yeah, and the other thing I think I would throw in too is sectors. You know, I'd love to do some sort of analysis since 2016 in this space, be it Brexit or industrial strategy. How many times have the words sectors and transport been used, and how many times have the words skills and education been used? And I'd be absolutely shocked if it wasn't hugely skewed towards transport and sectors. I think, you know, we haven't mentioned sectors once today because actually I think it's about or the challenge that places face is about attracting investment from a range of different sectors, and that comes down to being able to provide the workers that those types of sectors are looking for. And again, that just gets overlooked. Instead, we talk about the car industry or talk about another industry because it feels like we can conceptualize that a little bit better, talk about things in terms of sectors rather than perhaps talk about skills, which is really difficult in terms of having something to address that. And then in terms of transport, you know, I think it was interesting, you know, party conferences a couple of months back, it was sort of, the answer was transport. Oh, no, sorry. The answer was transport between cities. What was the question? That felt like every conversation that we heard in the rooms, the many rooms that we went into, that seemed to be the direction that it was going. Now, transport is important. We think that transport within cities is much more important than transport between cities. And that's principally because, you know, commuting is a cost. You know, why would people travel longer if they don't have to? The reason why people travel a long way into London is because actually wages in London are dead high, but so is the cost of housing, so people get pushed out. In somewhere around Manchester, around Leeds, you know, not only are the wages not as high as we would like, for a whole range of factors that we've discussed already, but actually housing is pretty cheap too. So why would you want to be based on the east side of Leeds and commute into Manchester every day when you could live, say, in Stockport and commute in much more quickly and much more efficiently? So we've got to be careful here that, you know, the grand projet is not the thing that politicians gravitate towards and say, we've got a big problem here, and the easy answer is we're going to spend billions of pounds on intercity transport, because actually that's not the big challenge that these places face. It is, you know, broken record time almost, but it is skills first off, and obviously all the things that Naomi set out in terms of the detail underneath that. And then if we are talking about transport, it's about transport within city regions, you know, linking people to jobs over a distance that they are willing to commute. That's where we're going to see a big difference.
Yeah, no, Naomi, I mean, in your conversations across the country in regards to local industrial strategies, I mean, transport, I mean, where is it in the scheme of things? Do you sense that there's a prioritisation and over-focus or not?
I think it's certainly part of the mix, and you know, there's a lot of conversation about at what scale should you be thinking about transport interventions. Is it right to be thinking at the city region level, or do we need to be thinking kind of pan city region? So it's certainly part of the conversation, but I think, you know, one of the issues is that kind of skills alongside things like transport is less kind of tangible and mm-hmm. visible, and the kind of the benefits from that type of investment tend to take a longer time to be revealed, which is, I think, in part why the kind of transport and infrastructure investments are kind of more popular. Mm. But I think it matters in terms of the inclusive growth conversation too. You know, I think every kind of authority that I've spoken to about the local industrial strategies has stated how they want the strategy to be supporting inclusive growth within their area. Of course, skills is a really important part of that, you know, it's much easier to see how you know, investment in education and skills is going to have direct benefits for residents. It's not always so clear how transport is going to benefit residents, particularly those living in deprived communities. So, you know, for instance, we know that improving transport links from a city centre location to a deprived community works to drive up house prices in that area. There's much less evidence that it does anything to tackle worklessness. So in effect, it might well just be raising cost of living for people living in that area, or worse, pushing them out of that area rather than doing anything to benefit them.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think that's really important. Another area, just get your reflections on. I mean, I think there's a sense that we've talked about the sort of economic origins of and the economic implications of Brexit, you know, but clearly there, you know, within the Brexit conversations and ultimately the decision, and then the fallout, you know, there is a strong political element, you know, to that as well. And you know, my sense is that when you go around the country to different places, yes, there is a sort of economic disenfranchisement. You know, we haven't seen the growth of the wages or the jobs that, you know, maybe other parts have, and, you know, and that's something we need addressing. But also a sense that there's a political disenfranchisement, you know, concerns and about Westminster and Whitehall, a kind of detached elite, you know, doesn't understand that, you know, what's going on in these sorts of places. And a real disenfranchisement on the decision-making side as well as on the political side as well as on the economic side. And again, you know, some, not least us, but some have said, you know, that Brexit offers an opportunity to, you know, to also tackle that political questions about how decisions get made and by whom those decisions get made, which kind of leads us towards some questions around around devolution. Paul, just your reflections on that, you know, kind of by that sort of an argument, and, you know, hopeful that we might be able to unlock some of these problems on the political side?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting in terms of where the finger of blame seems to be pointed around sort of lack of political control. I think definitely it feels like, or certainly the things that we hear, you know, since the referendum is in part it's been, well, you know, it's bureaucrats making decisions elsewhere and it's one end of the eye for the bureaucrats and we haven't got any say over how we run our lives, run our political system, how we run our economy in the local area. What is curious is that that's been manifested or being sort of communicated through a referendum for a European Union membership, and it seems that in part people have said, we don't like the EU telling us what to do, we want to take back control. Where exactly we're taking back control to, though, is it Westminster, is it local? There's a real sort of grey area there. I think what's quite interesting, sort of contrasting that, say, to the United States, and particularly I think with the political climate there at the moment, where there's very much a feeling that, you know, Washington has got too much power, actually, despite there being a great degree of devolution in America than in the UK. Washington has got too much power. You know, we don't want, you know, the federal government telling us what to do. You know, we want power back in our area, and indeed it seems like that's certainly the rise of sort of Donald Trump style politics is partly being based off the back of that. So in America it's been very much the fingers being pointed at national government. In the UK it's very much the fingers being pointed at European sort of political structures, for want of a better word. And it's the same feeling. It's that we haven't got control locally of things that matter to our lives, and we're being pushed around by bureaucrats who don't understand where we are. Or sort of what we need, but, you know, that finger is pointed over at Brussels rather than being pointed at Westminster. That then, I think, poses a very interesting question for bureaucrats and politicians that are within Westminster about when some of these powers are repatriated, what are they going to do? Because really what people seem to be saying in part is that we don't like being told what to do by people who are disconnected from our lives. Now that applies to politicians and civil servants in Westminster as much as it does within Brussels. But what will politicians do? Because really the message there should be, do you know what, we do need to pass more power down locally. And that's the message I think that is implicitly being sent out, if not explicitly. But of course there's a political choice there. And while I feel there was the appetite to pass some of that power down perhaps between 2010 and 2015, it doesn't feel like, certainly since the referendum, that appetite is as strong. And I'd say that's a very grey area, and I think there's still a lot that needs to be said around that to clarify. But, you know, we do think that more power should be passed down at the local level to both deal with the political issues that you raise, Andrew, but also deal with some of those economic challenges as well.
Yeah, Naomi, your reflections on, you know, the impact potentially of Brexit on, you know, the way that decisions get made and by whom, as much as, or as well as, the nature of those decisions themselves.
Well, I think, you know, one of the opportunities that was flagged during our work on the potential local impacts of Brexit was the kind of replacement of the EU funds and the opportunity there to design and deliver a policy in the form of the Shared Prosperity Fund that gave local and kind of city leaders greater flexibility to invest in their local economies in ways in which really reflected local circumstance. And I think that still is one of the biggest opportunities. But there, you know, obviously we're awaiting the consultation on the Shared Prosperity Fund. But I think there is opportunity to design and distribute that funding in a way that gives local leaders much greater flexibility than they've had in the past. And I think that's a really important part of the kind of devolution agenda going forward.
We could carry on kind of talking about Brexit and the implications of it for quite some time. And indeed, I'm sure this won't be the last time that we have conversations about the fallout and the implications, consequences of Brexit. But for now, just as close, but we'll start with you, Paul. In terms of, you know, messages to government and to cities, you know, about how to deal with or how to make the most of or at least mitigate the worst of Brexit. What are the kind of core messages that you would want to get across?
Well, the challenge for both national and local government is about trying to attract in this high skilled business investment that are going to create a great number of job opportunities, better paid job opportunities in areas that struggle, so that people will have access to better quality work, however you define that. But crucially, I think, you know, have more money in their pockets off the back of that too. Mm. And it's thinking about what are the fundamental drivers of that, and how are we going to design policy to try and improve the benefits that these places offer, because they have struggled to make that offer in the past. Their economies therefore have struggled, and in part you make an argument that actually the Brexit result is an outcome of that. Oh, yeah. Big alarm bell being sounded by this referendum vote. Let's do something about that. Mm. But it's got to be on those fundamental challenges that we look at, say, rather than perhaps some of the easy answers, which are, oh, it's about sectors, or it's about intercity transport. Mm.
Naomi, your sort of reflections or messages to both national and to cities around, you know, how we deal with Brexit.
Yeah, well, you know, I think at the moment there's obviously a great deal of uncertainty about what Brexit will eventually end up looking like and the impacts that it will have. So I think it's really important that government and local partners find ways to monitor the impacts of Brexit as they play out. But I think, as Paul says, it doesn't really change the fundamentals and the importance of those kind of fundamentals to economic development and growth. I think, you know, like I said earlier, what Brexit does is put kind of more significance on making sure that interventions are as effective as they possibly can be. So in some senses that means experimenting more with interventions and policies and evaluating those experiments, but also finding ways to share knowledge and best practice so that policy is more effective across the country.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I completely agree with that in a sense. You know, I think, as you say, both of you have been saying, Brexit does create an urgency in the nature of the response and how we do it. I think it does increase the importance of that response, but doesn't actually change the underlying rationale of why we need to do what we're doing, and we should hold to that when we're thinking about how the consequences and implications of Brexit plays out in the short term and in the long term. My guests today have been Paul Swinney and Naomi Clayton. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.